Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. A little later, we'll be hearing from Alex Fafar from the Ames Historical Society, who will be telling us about their new exhibit. And making a surprise Friday appearance, we'll have Susan Franzen, who is usually the host of the Wednesday Local Talk show. But Susan will be here to share some political history with us. And we'll have an interview with Kirsten Sullivan, who is a government teacher at Ames High School. She'll be talking about how her courses aim to develop young people who are politically aware and engaged. But first, it's Friday, and so it's time for the News Roundup, brought to us all the way from California by Dennis Hart.
This was another busy news week on the pages of the Ames Tribune and other nearby papers, so here we go. On Tuesday, the lead story in the Tribune is one that began making waves throughout Ames last Friday night. That's when 13 students in the Ames High School marching band removed themselves from the performance of the national anthem before that home football game against Des Moines Lincoln High School. Those 13 students, part of the approximately 300-member band group, left the football field and stood in the band section of the stadium before the performance of the Star-Spangled Banner, rather than play on the field with the rest of the band. Originally, the students had intended to take a knee. That's been done by numerous professional athletes in the past months, protesting racial injustices and alleged police brutality. But Ames High Principal Spence Evans asked the students to stay in the band section of the stadium if they chose not to play their instruments. Evans told the Tribune, in his words, "Obviously, they have First Amendment rights, but we also have a performance to put on." The students who chose not to take part in the national anthem left the field, walked into the stands, and linked arms with members of the student body in what Ames School Superintendent Tim Taylor called a show of unity. Associate Superintendent Mandy Ross said district officials had reached out to legal counsel before that Friday night game to ensure that everything was within school and student rights. One of the students who helped organize the protest said the purpose was to highlight inequality in the United States and to bring awareness to racial disparities. She told the Tribune that everyone in the country has the right to free speech, and that includes both the students who decided to walk off the field and those who disagree with that action. All of this generated an immense amount of reaction. Social media platforms were ablaze with comments, with opinions ranging from calling the students' actions disrespectful, disgraceful, and a tantrum. Some Twitter users demanded the firing of Ames High's principal and the band director. Others called for the band to be disbanded, and some voiced their support for the students. Superintendent Taylor says that since the game, the Ames School District has received hate mail from across the nation. Taylor said he hopes the students are not getting any of the same messages the district is getting. Also on the Tribune's front page on Tuesday, a story about the Democratic Party's fall barbecue fundraising event that took place on Sunday at Prairie Moon Winery. Democratic Representatives John Delaney of Maryland and Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii were the keynote speakers at the event, which raises money for Democrats in Boone, Greene, Grundy, Hamilton, Hardin, and Story counties, and for Iowa State University Democrats. Delaney said the biggest problem in government right now is the inability to get anything done. He said, in his words, "We never spend any time talking about the things we agree on." He said people in the United States need to start coming together to prepare the country for the future and called it an opportunity for Democrats to lead the unity charge. He said one area of possible agreement involves infrastructure. He also said lawmakers need to work toward a new social contract, toward bettering K-12 education, and toward making the U.S. more entrepreneurial. Gabbard said much the same thing. She said by embracing what she calls the spirit of aloha, Americans and lawmakers could rise above the hatred and darkness and divisiveness that has pervaded much of our politics. Like Delaney, Gabbard mentioned bipartisan efforts to improve infrastructure, veteran services, and education. She said conflict between Democrats and Republicans is to be expected, and she said Democrats have to stop fighting among themselves. She said Democrats are going to have different ways, different approaches on how best to get things done, but in her words, the point is we can disagree on the how-to without being disagreeable, as long as we are centered and focused on that mission of service. Also in Tuesday's Tribune, word that three men were arrested Monday after police say they robbed a campus town apartment and assaulted the resident. Two of those arrested are from Ames, one is from Omaha. All were charged with second-degree robbery. Police say officers were flagged down early Monday morning by witnesses who said they had seen three men running away with large suitcases from an apartment complex in the 2300 block of Lincoln Way. The witnesses told officers they overheard one of the men saying they had to go because the police would soon be there, and he did not want to go back to jail. Officers said the robbery victim told them the three men had stolen several items and that when he tried to stop them, one of the suspects assaulted him with a glass bottle, causing minor cuts and bruises. Police caught up with the three suspects a short time later, and they were taken to Story County Jail. In Wednesday's Tribune, the big front-page story was about the Story County Board of Supervisors, who on Tuesday approved the first reading of a revised version of the county's animal control ordinance that introduces new language involving animal hoarding. If it's eventually passed, that ordinance would prohibit anyone in the county from engaging in animal hoarding, housing animals in unclean conditions that put their health in jeopardy. It further defines hoarding as the failure to dispose of dead animals and the lack of proper nutrition, sanitation, shelter, and care for the pets. The revised ordinance also includes new penalty options that a judge can consider for people who violate any part of it. Under the new ordinance, authorities could issue one blanket citation for animal hoarding rather than individual citations for each mistreated animal. In extreme hoarding situations, that can rack up hundreds of citations and lots of paperwork with the potential of the case becoming quite time-consuming. The supervisors passed the proposed changes unanimously. Board Chairman Rick Sanders said the county is not trying to, in his words, big brother anyone, but he said the county is looking for ways to reasonably protect the animals. Under the penalties section of the code, the new language would give a judge three more punishment options to potentially impose on an offender who engaged in any prohibited practices. The judge could ban the offender from possessing an animal for the length of his or her sentence, order the offender to surrender his or her animal to the county shelter, or instruct the offender to go through a mental health evaluation and follow through with any treatment, or a combination of those options. Story County Animal Control Director Sue McCaskey told the board, "It's not unusual for county officers to come across homes that hold dozens of pets, sometimes in terrible conditions." She mentioned one example in which county officials entered a small home with about 75 cats inside. The proposed changes also include new definitions for animal cruelty and both neglected and suffering conditions for animals. The second reading of the ordinance is scheduled at the Board of Supervisors next Tuesday. Also in Wednesday's Tribune, a report on the Ames City Council meeting on Tuesday night. One of the things discussed, that Ames High School marching band protest at last Friday night's football game. City Council member Tim Garten said he had received what he called disturbing emails about the students who protested. He said he knows some of those students and called them model students. Mayor Ann Campbell also said she has received anonymous emails, adding that she's open to having a dialogue on the issue. Also at that council meeting, city staff walked council members through some proposed changes to the Ames Utility Code. Two of the bigger proposed changes involve requiring a water meter for each individual dwelling, including apartments, homes, and mobile homes, and mandating that any water service line be replaced instead of just repaired. City staff could bring those suggested changes to the council for its first approval as early as next week. The council also approved the inclusion of $2.3 million in improvements in the city's capital improvement plan for the water pollution control facility south of Ames. The money would be used to allow the plant to use its existing co-generating engines as well as a boiler to handle digester gas, which comes from decomposing waste and which can be turned into renewable energy. The council also approved a request from the Boys and Girls Club of Story County to hold its Over the Edge event in Campustown on October 27th. In Thursday's Trib, one of the big front-page stories was about the public forum held Wednesday night for Ames mayoral and city council candidates at the library. A big crowd turned out and watched as the candidates fielded questions about how to make Ames a more inclusive city. Representatives from different community groups asked questions at the forum, which was put on by the Ames Progressive Alliance. Among the first two questions, how should the city help the school district and its board address racial disparities, both academic and otherwise, in the schools? And how can it negate alleged racial injustices in the city? Mayoral candidate Victoria Zapinski praised Ames High band members who had protested during last Friday's football game. She said her campaign was about including diverse voices and perspectives. She told the crowd, in her words, "As a community, we need to be responsible, to be caring about all our young people, making sure that they're ready to do whatever it is they want to do when they leave Ames." She also said the city needs to be welcoming and aware of how it presents itself. John Hala, who is running against Sapinski for mayor, said he is passionate about working with others, and the first thing he would do is reach out to the school board and district administration to build relationships and understand what's going on. He said, in his words, "While I want to leave it in the purview of the school board specifically, I believe that we can be supportive and look for ways to work together. He also said the Ames Police Department has gone through training related to racial profiling and plans to go through more. One questioner asked what the candidates would tangibly do to ease feelings of alienation in Ames' black community. Hala said he would engage the community on how to break down barriers. Sapinski said she wants to facilitate better community relations, bringing together groups who, in her words, want to do better. Also in Thursday's Tribune, a report on Wednesday's Planning and Zoning Commission meeting, in which the commission recommended a change to the North Growth Area to allow a convenience store near a planned subdivision. A developer is requesting that two of his company's plots of land, southwest of the Ames Golf and Country Club, be part of the allowable growth zone for single and multifamily homes, along with a convenience store at the intersection of George Washington Carver Avenue and Cameron School Road. The commission also recommended that the city of Ames approve a preliminary plat for a new residential subdivision in the west part of the city. The nearly 11-acre plot of land just southeast of the West Ames Hy-Vee is owned by the city. A private developer wants to build a subdivision with 37 single-family homes for low- to moderate-income families. The commission also recommended that the city council approve a site development plan for two apartment buildings near the Iowa State University Research Park. The 8-unit apartments would be built at 3305 and 3315 Aurora Avenue. Also in Thursday's Trib, a story about a teach-in held at the Collegiate United Methodist Church on Wednesday. About 35 people attended the teach-in, which was about the future of both state and federal health care programs in the wake of numerous attempts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The event was hosted by the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Group. The guest speaker was Michael Lighty, the Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United. He told the crowd that what's needed in the United States is universal health care. He said health care is under attack in the United States because of drug companies, insurance companies, and hospital corporations, all of which dominate the health care system based on profit, he said. From the pages of the Nevada Journal this week, Nevada high school students are getting set to put on a special world premiere show on November 3rd and 4th in the community auditorium. It's a play called Breaking News, and it's said to be the first time the show will be performed on stage at any level. Breaking News is a satirical look at the influence of the media and social media on a local high school. 48 students are part of the cast, and 20 students are working behind the scenes on the play's crew. Also in the journal, word that Nevada agriculture education students and FAA members recently harvested, processed, and marketed pumpkins. They collaborated with Jensen Farms of Ankeny and marketed more than 200 pumpkins to individuals and to the Nevada Fairway store. In addition, some pumpkins were donated within the school system for art class and for volleyball team activities. From the pages of the Boone News Republican this week, Boone Moose Lodge 104 is seeking donations to help support 180 soldiers in the Boone National Guard unit who are now stationed at Fort Hood in Texas. The soldiers will be deployed from Fort Hood on December 8th. The Moose Lodge is looking for such donated items as travel-sized baby powder, toothpaste, toothbrushes, floss, travel-sized mouthwash, razors, shaving cream, feminine products, beef jerky, gum, and reading material. Donations can be dropped off at the Moose Lodge at 812 8th Street in Boone. The deadline to donate is Monday, November 20th. Also in the News Republican this week, the city of Boone looking for volunteers who would be interested in maintaining the beauty of Boone's park areas. The city has 17 parks along with the cemetery and the pool. One of the ways people can help is through an Adopt-a-Park program where individuals can plant flowers and help maintain the park, though mowing would not be required of volunteers. Another way of volunteering is through a neighborhood watch program geared toward picking up trash and contacting the park office if anything is broken or found to be broken. From the Story City Herald this week, word that a public tour this coming Sunday will give residents a chance to see the problems the Roland Story School District sees at the football track stadium and at the high school auditorium. The tour starts at 4 p.m. Sunday afternoon at the north gate of the football field. Voters are going to be asked to approve a bond measure next February to fix up the current football track complex and the auditorium. The district says curtains inside the auditorium do not meet fire code standards. Lighting on the stage is too hot and has apparently contributed to students fainting during performances. The auditorium was built 27 years ago. Energy efficiency would be improved with updated lighting and equipment. The auditorium is used almost daily during the school year. As for the football facility, it was built back in the 1940s. The district says there are issues involving safety, flooding, space, and the environment. Parking and sidewalks are limited, causing fans to walk to and from the stadium on busy streets, often in the dark. The football field has flooded 8 times in the past 9 years. That flooding is damaging the track and field surface, causing increased cost for repair. In addition, stadium seating is limited to room for about 850 on the home bleachers and 250 on the visitors' bleachers. Also in the Herald this week, residents of Roland, Story City, Randall, Gilbert, Ames, and surrounding areas being encouraged to attend one of the two upcoming listening sessions concerning the development of a watershed management plan to address water issues along the South Skunk River. The first session will take place this coming Monday, October 23rd, from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Franklin Community Room at Gilbert City Hall. The second one, it will take place on the Iowa State campus on October 30th. Organizers of the sessions hope to learn more about what farmers, community groups, and local government agencies are already doing for conservation and talk about opportunities for collaboration. And that's a look at a very, very busy news week in and around Ames. I'll be back next Friday morning, and we'll do it all over again.
That was the Local News Roundup with Dennis Hart. As Dennis said, you can hear that each Friday on Local Talk. We have an additional news item about an event that's coming up. There will be a listening session concerning the development of a watershed management plan for the Keegley Branch and the South Skunk River. This will take place Monday, October 23rd, from 6 to 7 in the Franklin Community Room at Gilbert City Hall. Kara Reinhart, biology teacher at Gilbert High School, and her students will present findings from their biological monitoring project on Keegley Branch and other local streams. Continuing with the theme of student engagement in important issues, earlier this week, I sat down with Kirsten Sullivan, who teaches advanced placement government and U.S. government at Ames High School. We were interested in hearing about these courses and how they promote civic engagement and work to create informed citizens and voters. Ames High School has also been in the news this past week, as Dennis Hart just described, because of political actions and a protest at the football game last Friday. So Ms. Sullivan also gives us some insights into the processes that led to Friday night and the student learning that occurred leading up to it and since.
AP and U.S. government are taught to primarily seniors. Government is required to graduate from Ames High School. Our civic responsibility projects that we expect of all students happen whether you're in AP or in regular.
And you mentioned civic responsibility. Is that something that you would say is one of the goals of the courses?
Yes, definitely. My colleague, Leah Stearns, and I, who teach all the government classes, all levels, we give an assignment at the beginning of each semester. Government is a single semester course. So at the beginning of each semester, we explain to the students the civic responsibility project expectations that we have. One of our goals as teachers of government is that students understand how important it is to be present and to engage in their society, that we have a wonderful opportunity to participate. And when they choose not to participate, they are basically giving the decisions to others to make for them, and that to get the most out of your community, both local and larger, you need to engage and participate. And so we have several projects where we have the kids doing more active learning in order to get a real-life sense of what civic responsibility is. For example, Every student goes to a public meeting of elected officials. They have to attend. They write a little summary. They write a reflection. We give them some probative questions to consider. And it has to be elected, people who are elected to represent them. So they'll go to a city council meeting or a school board meeting, or I even have students go to county supervisors occasionally. In the spring semester, students will even go down to the legislature. But they must be elected, and then they can witness things just like parliamentary procedure. Mm-hmm. A lot of them come back and say, I was surprised to know that the city council was responsible for this action. And it's, again, just to get them involved locally. And some of them come back and they're still bored and don't see the point. But honestly, the vast majority are sort of intrigued by the process that they didn't know about. Something else we have them do is write to their elected officials. So they'll write a letter to the school board or to city council or the mayor, even the legislature, all the way up to the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate or the president. And they are to pick a topic that's important to them. We tell them, don't think of it as an assignment. Think of it as a way to communicate with a person who represents you, and to pose a question, encouraging them to write back to them. And we try to guide them a little about, you're not going to write to the president because you're mad about snow removal. you know, be appropriate, think about what you're asking. But we also let them sort of discover that, because we have the philosophy that, I mean, if an adult wrote a letter to an elected official and it was maybe not the right question, the elected official could still steer them in the right direction mm-hmm. to get an answer. And so that's the goal, is for them to realize, hey, I can ask this and I can get an answer to my question, whatever the question was. So probably the most important thing we do, I think my colleague would agree, is service learning. It's a board requirement for graduation, but we route it through government because it is a part of civic responsibility. So the mm-hmm. government teachers facilitate it, but it's actually a graduation requirement. And the students can choose. We ask them to not do things that they would, you know, maybe they're already doing. They can't, you know, double dip. You need to think of something, you know, outside of what you would already normally do. So we have students volunteer at Food at First, or they work on a political campaign. They do all sorts of things, work at the wildlife care clinic at the university. Those are the kinds of things that we ask the students to think about, just being engaged in your community and realizing, you know, that they have something to give back that matters.
And we have some important elections coming up in Ames this fall, and I understand that some students have selected to get involved in campaigning.
Yes. Both mayoral campaigns reached out to me asking if there were any students who would be willing to, you know, or interested in volunteering, which is very exciting because I think it helps them understand the process if they are actively involved. And so we distributed their information to students. And I know that students were interested in getting involved on both sides. I don't know yet, because the project isn't completed, mm-hmm. exactly what they did. But I know that several kids went door knocking and canvassing with candidates and mayoral candidates. And we're excited about, you know, feeling like they're making a difference. Like, I may help the mayor get elected, and that's pretty neat. And when you can own it, when you have that efficacy, you're more likely to be engaged and stay engaged. So it's really exciting.
I know when I was young, I would never have thought of, nor do I think the school would have given that kind of opportunity or encouragement for high school students to be involved in that way and at that level.
My goal as a government teacher is that my students understand how important it is to be a voter, to be engaged. And I think government teachers, even, you know, before me, it was a priority to be active. And Ames is a community where it's easy to be active. Iowa is a politically active state. So I think all of that, you know, the climate makes it easier to encourage students to do it. And there are some who maybe aren't quite ready. They're maybe a little intimidated or a little nervous about it. But to see their peers do it, you know, helps. But I think you're right. When I was in high school, I went to, you know, a small high school in Texas, and, you know, we didn't see candidates there the way we see them here. So I think it makes a difference. They, of course, my students think that this is how it is everywhere. They're surprised when they go somewhere else and they meet a friend at a college in a different state. And what, you didn't meet every candidate? They're a little surprised by that. So they can go down to the Grove downtown and, you know, have coffee with a candidate visiting town, and they don't see that that's not how it is everywhere. Most places aren't like that. So,
and another thing that's been happening is some of the students have chosen to become involved in protests and actions, in particular at the most recent football game. And I know there's been a lot of reaction to that in the community and online and in the media. How do you see that as connecting to your goal as a government teacher?
Well, I think it fits exactly what we're trying to do. The students are very active. They have a lot of opinions, and they watch the news. They read. They're very aware of what's going on in the world, in the nation, and they want to participate. And I would think that between my class and other classes at the high school that they're taking, where they're asking bigger life questions, makes them want to be involved more. And so when the students were talking about doing this, you know, I really encouraged them to, I said, you know, number one, you have to be sure that you can own the behavior, that you understand what you believe, and that you're not doing it because your friend is, or because, you know, your girlfriend thinks you should, or that you're doing it because it's what you feel strongly about. And you also have to think about, you know, can you handle the consequences that they're, you know, protest is not easy. Protest doesn't happen when it's convenient. Protest makes things uncomfortable. But if it's an issue that needs to be brought to light and they feel strongly about it, It's very offensive to me when adults want to diminish the importance of a student's feeling about an issue. I mean, they're learning how to be young adults, and part of learning how to navigate those waters is to participate. And they're going to make mistakes, certainly, but so do adults. And somehow when they're adults, we forgive it. And when they're students, we say, oh, they're just kids. And I vehemently disagree with that. I think that watching these students, you know, I told them yesterday that I have a lot of proud moments being at Ames High School, but this last weekend might have been one of my proudest because they handled the conflict. The entire thing was student-led. The confusion, the frustration, that we need to talk about this all came from the students, and then they sorted it out. The only thing administration did, they gave them a forum to talk to each other in the middle of the day because that's sort of difficult when everyone's going class to class. And the kids sorted it out, and the administration said, you need to decide what you want to do, and then you need to own it. And they did, and it was respectful. And if you looked in the student section, you saw kids in pink for breast cancer awareness. You saw kids in red, white, and blue who wanted to go ahead and wear those colors. You saw a kid in a Trump shirt and a kid with a flag and a kid in orange and black. And they were all together, and there was no conflict. The band members who decided to sit out the anthem did so respectfully. They did not make a scene. They did not stop the performance. They walked aside. The administration had asked them to consider please doing it that way so the performance could continue, which they did. And they were very respectful. They didn't draw a lot of attention to themselves. But they felt strongly about what they believed. And there was a lot of backlash from the public. But the band members, in fact, I asked them, you know, how was band today? How did it go on Monday? And did you feel supported? And they all looked at me like they couldn't believe I'd even asked that question because, of course, we're supported in the band. And, you know, they were worried about their directors being treated badly. They wanted to have each other's backs. And I thought, my gosh, we could learn, you know, a whole lot of adults could learn from that. It was reasonable and rational and mature and they had the right to do it. I mean, the court said they have the right to do it. You know, that you don't leave your rights at the schoolhouse door, says Tinker versus Des Moines. And so, yeah, I don't teach them to protest and I don't teach them not to protest, but I teach them that they absolutely have the right to. They have to be mature enough to handle what goes along with it. But that's part of being an American.
And is that particular case, Tinker versus Des Moines, something that you teach in the course?
I do. We, in both courses, in AP, we have 40 court cases that we go through over the course of the semester. And so we do a lot deeper digging in AP. But in regular U.S. government, we also do a court case study in our judiciary unit, and Tinker is one of those cases. We try to include cases that are relevant to high school students as students. Search cases. Tinker, of course, is a speech case. And it happened in Des Moines. So it was a landmark national case, but it happened sort of in their backyard. So we talk about those, that these are things that are applicable to you, that are not things that happen over there to those people, but they happen, you know, to us as Americans. And so we do talk about that case and several others that have to do with high school students.
Could you just say a bit about that particular case, as some listeners might not be familiar with it?
Sure. John and Mary Beth Tinker were students in high school in Des Moines and were protesting the Vietnam War by wearing black armbands. And they were told by administration that they would be, you know, punished, suspended, I think, if they wore the armbands, and they did it anyway. And so they followed through with the punishment. And so there was a lawsuit that went to the court, and the court ruled that you don't lose your right to free speech just because you're a student. Mm-hmm. And Abe Forda said, you don't check your rights at the schoolhouse door. And so the idea is that they weren't being disruptive. They weren't being destructive. They weren't interrupting class. They weren't harming, you know, the school facility. They were wearing an armband, and it was peaceful and it was quiet, and they felt strongly and they had the right to do it. And the school, being a public school representing the state, was limiting that speech, and the First Amendment protects that at all levels, well, because the 14th Amendment incorporates it to affect all levels, but they can't do it. The state can't do it. And so I was interested to see how it would go in Ames because Ames mm-hmm. is a public school as well. And in my opinion, it was handled beautifully. The administration guided but did not decide. And the students, they owned their behavior. So I think it was good. I think a lot of people could learn from it. And mm-hmm. I would hope that, you know, if somebody feels the need to spew vitriol or call the school district and be nasty, and let me tell you, we got a lot of that, that they think before they speak, take a lesson from the students.
How's your AP course or the U.S. government course changed this year, or has it been different in any way because of the political climate that seems to be around us?
It has. It has a little bit. I try very hard to teach the students about the different political parties and different political ideology. We do a survey where they answer a lot of different questions to try to figure out sort of where they fall ideologically. I've not normalized the current presidency. I talked with my principal and other colleagues about it, and we agreed that, you know, when a student says, you know, I heard that the president made an inappropriate action towards a woman, you know, that's not okay. You know, we've said, you're right, that's not okay. It's not. A lot of times students, when they're learning, not so much seniors but younger students, you know, they think they're the president. They must do everything right. And so we've not normalized it and made it seem like this is, you know, this is how it always is. But at the same time, we've just tried to separate it. So we still talk about ideology and we still talk about party platform, the branches of government, the judiciary, the Bill of Rights, court cases. We've talked about all of those things. But the students do know that the seniors are aware as new young voters that this was a very different election. We've tried to look at why the election turned out the way it did when polls were pointing in a different direction. We talk about economic voters. We have talked about racial issues. I mean, you know, we've even talked a little bit about the Russia piece, but not too much because there's not much evidence out there yet about that, and we don't want to speculate. But that there are a lot of pieces, and that polls tend to poll likely voters, people who have voted in the past, and a lot of people who were eligible but not necessarily likely showed up to vote, and that changed things. So we've tried to just look at sort of the why. And in political science, you know, everything is slow in political science as far as looking at in the aggregate at why things happen. But, you know, we can try to look and think about why people vote the way they do. And in my classroom, I have, you know, kids who maybe they didn't support Trump because they were not voting yet, but their families did. We had a lot of students who their families supported Hillary Clinton. We have some who said they didn't vote because they didn't like Trump or Hillary. You know, so we sort of have everybody. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do is just have a dialogue and make sure that all views are represented. It's absolutely not tolerated for anyone to attack another person's idea. And I don't really have a problem with that because the students know that we're going to have a civil discourse about issues. We're not going to attack each other. But that doesn't mean that we don't talk about difficult things. Mm-hmm. One of my biggest priorities is that the students know why they believe what they believe. And so I ask them if, you know, they come to school with a Trump shirt on and we talk about we're talking about something with ideology, then I'll say, well, you know, explain to me why you would support the president or why you would believe that. And I would say the same thing to a student with a Bernie shirt on or a Hillary shirt, trying to get them to see that, you know, you can support whoever you want. You just need to know why. And this is the time of their life where they start potentially disagreeing with mom and dad a little bit. I remember taking my college-age son to the caucuses, and I was so excited that we were going to caucus together, and he didn't want to caucus with me. He went to another candidate. But that's how it's supposed to be. They're supposed to figure it out. But the way they do that is to really understand the platforms. And we've also tried to talk about ideology outside of party. You know, third parties played a role in this and took not a front seat, but, you know, really had a showing in the last election. And both the Green Party and Libertarian parties have been, you know, making gains. And that's good for American politics for that to happen. So we've tried to talk about that, too. And when we do our survey, a lot of the students will say, you know, what's a libertarian? My survey mm-hmm. came up libertarian. I don't even know what that is. You know, I'm the Green Party. Let's talk about that. And then they realize, wow, so many of my responses were about the environment. That must be why my results showed up this way. And so they're learning about themselves and about what they believe. And that's my job. And I tell them, I said, I have zero interest in what you believe personally in my classroom. You need to believe what you believe, but you just need to know why. And if you don't know why, then let's ask questions and let's figure it out. So when you go out to vote for the first time, you have some idea. Or at least you know how to ask questions. Mm-hmm. You know, we try to make them lifelong learners when they leave us. That's why participating in campaigns is so great, because then they realize I can call up a candidate and say, hey, what do you think about this? Or I can look on a website, or I can call a campaign manager, and I can ask questions that matter to me when they write their letter to their official. I'm thinking about this that matters to me. And that's how they learn what they believe. But if they don't do it, if they don't practice it, then they don't necessarily trust the process until, you know, they're in their 30s, and we want them to trust it now. 18 to 25-year-olds are the least likely age-wise demographic to vote, yet they have a lot to gain. I tell them that, you know, voting is a tremendous action toward you advocating for yourself. Not voting is also an action, but it's just by inaction. You're giving that responsibility to somebody else, and it's your choice. But gosh, wouldn't it be great if you could just have a say? And so that's what we try. Well, I have great partners. Our staff is top-notch, and thinking and asking bigger life questions happen in all disciplines. And so when they come to me, they're already, you know, ready to kind of process like that. And maybe not doing it in about their government is different, but they know how they understand that an opinion without, you know, that are baseless, in fact, you know, are significantly less valid, if valid at all, versus something that is a reasoned judgment that has basis to it. And so because we all prioritize that idea of thinking and learning, it makes my job a lot easier.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Kirsten Sullivan, a government teacher at Ames High School, giving us some perspectives about recent protests from inside the high school. And we've been joined in the studio by two new guests, Alex Fafar from the Ames Historical Society and Susan Franson, who is a producer and reporter at KHOI. And we are going to be talking about history. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Alex, we're going to start with you because there's a new exhibit at the Historical Society that's opening up. Tell us about it.
Yeah, things are always changing over there. We just put up a new one last week. If you saw our World War II, and we've been talking about that for quite a few months on here,
right,
and things connected. So World War II's over, everybody.
It ended.
Yay. VE and VJ Day. Yay. So now we're going to talk a little bit about immigration, actually, which I think is a great timely topic right now. So we're very excited to get this exhibit in. It's called In Trunks, Hands, and Hearts, What Immigrants Brought to the United States. And this is a traveling exhibit. So this is one that was put together by the Norwegian American Museum in Decorah, Iowa. So if anybody's ever been out there, it is a wonderful, wonderful museum. They've had that for, I think it's over 100 years old at this point. They've had it as long as I think Luther College has been in town there. So, you know, a huge Norwegian population up in that area, kind of mm-hmm. similar to our Story City area. And so it's a nice traveling exhibit that's coming up, you know, between 1825 and 1980, nearly 1 million Norwegians left for new lives in America, which is, you know, we definitely think about the 1860s at that point, especially here in Iowa. That's when, you know, places like Story City and Decorah started to get settled. But this also, not only does it tell those early, you know, stories about homesteaders in the 1860s, it also gets into more newer stories. So we're not just talking about, you know, people coming over and homesteading. We're talking about people through all generations. I think the most recent one we have on there is talking about some Bosnian immigrants coming in the 1990s. I think it's important that, you know, people usually have that, you know, Norwegian, German immigrant story in their head, but sometimes we forget that that story never stopped, that it kept continuing through different people bringing that on. So this exhibit explores a lot of reasons for leaving. So we talk about what concerns. Sometimes it's for a better life. Sometimes, you know, war plays a part into that. And it also talks about what they brought. That was really important. So, you know, obviously themselves, you know, things, quilts, blankets, tools, but trades and experiences and stuff like that, that they came over and helped kind of define America by what they were helping, you know, building houses or working for the railroad or, you know, being professors, that kind of stuff. It's really an amazing story. And so we have – it's kind of a two-part over there. We have the Vesterheim half, and then we also have some panels on the boards that we've done at the Ames Historical Society that talk about some of our local stories too. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to be able to put a local face onto that. So I think we have about – when I was over there a minute ago, I counted five panels talking about different ethnicities coming over. So – you know, German is one we'd expect. We're talking about the Friedrichs, if you're familiar with Friedrich Realty. They came Reini Friedrich, his father, Reinhard, came over in the 1920s after World War I in between there. So he came over to help start getting – he got into the real estate business and building, and that's kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
We also talked about a few little kind of newer stories like Vietnamese refugees coming over in the 1960s during the war. And I didn't know this until I started doing some research, but we have Iowa has one of the largest Vietnamese and Laos populations outside of Vietnam, which is just kind of wild to think about.
Yeah, thanks to a Republican governor,
right.
Robert Ray.
There we go, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really – it was an amazing story to read some of that. So it's kind of fun. We have, you know, the old traditional immigrant stories that you expect to read about, people coming over, building, you know, sod houses, that kind of stuff. But then also these newer ones with people mm-hmm. coming over. We also have one about a family from India that came over and he became a math professor over at Iowa State. And so, you know, it's not just people coming over working on the railroad. It's people coming mm-hmm. over with, you know, high-end professions too, that kind of stuff. So it's going to be really – it's really cool. We're really excited to be the first stop too also for this from Vesterheim.
And so it's – the traveling museum that focuses on Norwegian, and then you've added some local components to cover different groups.
Exactly, yeah. And their story tells much more than just their Norwegian one, like that the Bosnia story in 1992 where I think they had a woman that she basically left that day. She took a few clothes, a loaf of bread out of the oven and left Bosnia. And so they've incorporated all kinds of stories. And they've incorporated one of the Ames stories into the bigger one. So after it leaves Ames here, there'll still be a little chunk of Ames traveling with it. They'll be talking about the Torones family. They were a Mexican-American family that came up in the teens. And I believe he worked for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad here. We have his pickaxe on display if you want to come down and see that. It's a pretty big item. And his family continued to live in Ames. They had many children, and I think there's still a couple of them around town here, if mm-hmm. I'm not mistaken. So, it's going to be great.
It sounds like it's something very timely to think about, especially the reasons why immigrants came and what was important to them and what they brought with them, because I think that's still relevant to immigrants today.
Oh, definitely, yeah. We're having, you know, all kinds of issues going around, and immigration's been a hot topic the last couple of years, especially about, you know, who can come in, who can't. So it's great to keep that conversation going and put a historical perspective to it, too, because we're all immigrants here, basically, besides the first, you know, the first Americans.
And is there a talk that accompanies this?
Yes, there will be. Next Tuesday, if you're not busy, we'll have a free talk over at the Ames Public Library. And that'll be given through Vesterheim is supporting this. And so that'll be by Laura Ann Gilbertson. And Laura actually has an Ames connection. So she has her bachelor's in anthropology and her master's in textile and clothing, both from Iowa State University. She's been the textile curator at Vesterheim for the last 19 years and is now the chief curator. And so she oversees the collection of over 30,000 artifacts and, you know, creates exhibits and leads a textile study tour to Norway even. So that'll be great. So the name of the talk is similar to the exhibit, In Trunks, Hands, and Hearts, What Norwegian Immigrants Brought to the United States. So they'll be specifically talking about mm-hmm. the Norwegian thing since that is their main focus over at their museum. Yeah, so that'll be free on October 24th. That's next Tuesday at 7 p.m. in the Ames Public Library Auditorium.
And we'll put information on that up on the website and the link.
Perfect.
All right, let's get Susan into the conversation here. Susan, you're going to tell us about an important moment in Ames history, which you were a part of, that illustrates the importance of civic engagement, which we were talking about earlier in the program.
Yes, and I am fascinated by what Alex is talking about. I can hardly wait to get over and see your exhibit. But I've come today with a history of my own. Now, it's not my history, but as so many programs are now about city government, I want to go back a quarter of a century to the time that Ames City Council refused to extend protection against discrimination to gay, lesbian, and bisexual citizens. I think it's appropriate to think about that as we prepare to vote for a new mayor and city council. Not that this is still an issue, but the history of the way citizens turned that around is still inspiring. Full disclosure, I was actively involved in the controversial struggle as a member of the Ames Civil Rights Task Force. Do you have any records on that organization on file at the Ames Historical Society, Alec?
I think we might have a couple. We'll have to go check back in our archives. We have quite a few city documents, but I'm sure if we don't have it, that the city still has a copy for sure.
Okay. Well, I think it deserves to be remembered. So here I go. The story begins in the spring of 1984, before Disney and major corporations had discovered that they needed to prove themselves gay-friendly or risk losing talented employees. This was a time when local people actually said, "Why do we need that ordinance? There aren't any gay people in Ames." Others said, "If you pass that, Ames will be just like San Francisco." We thought that was a little funny. Do we get the City of Lights bookstore? But to get back to the story, a student had brought a discrimination case to the Ames Human Relations Commission. He had been denied an apartment because he was gay. And he brought his case to the commission, which made the decisions on cases of discrimination. The chair of the commission was Russell Pounds, a retired chief warrant officer who had become an agricultural economics professor at Iowa State after his retirement and had become involved in local Ames issues. When he first came to Ames in the 1960s, he faced discrimination in housing because he was African American. With his friend Charlie Hammer and others, he organized a campaign for an opening housing ordinance in the 1960s. I remember the little signs you might put in your door that said it was a white equal sign on a black background. You may have seen some of those with other colors more recently. That led him to sit on the Ames Human Relations Commission after they had the first ordinance passed to protect against discrimination. When he heard the case brought by the gay man, he and the rest of the commission recognized it as discrimination in housing that was similar to what he had experienced. The commission agreed, however, there was nothing they could do about it because the Ames Human Relations Ordinance didn't include sexual orientation in its list of protected classes. Therefore, by unanimous vote, they appealed to the Ames City Council to amend the ordinance. Pounds recognized discrimination when he saw it. And Charlie Hammer just happened to be on the Ames City Council at the time. So he immediately offered to bring the request for an ordinance change to the council for approval. As soon as their decision was announced in the Ames Tribune, a group of conservative ministers appealed to the mayor, who was himself an Episcopal priest, to oppose the proposed ordinance change, and they appealed to other ministers to join them. They formed a group calling themselves Citizens Against the Homosexual Privileges Amendment. It looked as if those opposing the ordinance change had an active and vocal group of supporters. Those who favored the ordinance change believed they needed to counter that. And they did. They formed a group called the Ames Civil Rights Task Force. I read about it first, its first meeting in the Ames Tribune, and attended the second meeting. The strategy of the group was to appoint a spokesperson to support the proposed ordinance change publicly in radio and TV interviews and to find people to write letters to the editor to support the ordinance and to counter letters from the Citizens Against the Homosexual Privileges Amendment. After its first meeting, members of the Ames Civil Rights Task Force approached four well-known citizens and asked each of them to serve as spokesperson for the group. All refused. So the job of appointing a spokesperson fell to our small group during the second meeting. This was a real eye-opener for me, since I knew most of the gay and lesbian members of the group, and none of them was willing to speak out publicly in support of the ordinance change. the straight members saw no problem with supporting the proposal of the Ames Human Relations Commission, so we divided the task of responding among ourselves. We soon had plenty to respond to. There were quarter-page ads in the Ames Tribune with drawings of a child saying, "Do you want your child taught by a practicing homosexual?" And there was the ostrich ad. There was a big picture of an ostrich with its head in the sand and said, "Don't put your head in the sand. This is what will happen if we pass this ordinance." And, of course, there were letters to the editor and a radio debate. The most important initiative by the Ames Civil Rights Task Force was a signature ad supporting the Ames Human Relations Commission proposal. When it was published as a half-page ad, there were over 500 signatures, and these were leading citizens. Although it didn't have the desired effect on the city council, it made a difference on the personal level. Closeted gay people and virtually all gay and lesbian people in Ames were unwilling to be publicly identified in 1984, but they could be with their allies on the signature ad, and then they knew who their allies were. People throughout Ames studied that list. Alex, do you suppose you could help me locate a copy of the ad?
Yeah, from maybe the 1990s. It's a little bit difficult sometimes. Until we get our paper digitized locally, we can only look up newspaper articles by keyword search prior to 1978 because of a subscription we use through a private company. So if it's after that, it's a little bit difficult unless you know the exact date of the paper. You have to actually go to the microfilm and just go through page by page and hope that you pick the right month that you remember it in.
Well, maybe we could just wait a few years until we can get the digital service.
Yeah, they add a year every year. So right now we're in 1978. So everything before 1978 we can search digitally. Everything after is a little bit of a guessing Easter egg hunt.
Okay. When the vote in the city council came, the council chambers were packed and both supporters and opponents were given half an hour. Ours was tightly organized with each person who spoke for it sticking to our schedule. The opponents rambled and interrupted each other. Charlie Hammer moved that the council approve the recommendation of the Ames Human Relations Commission. It died for lack of a second. There are two lessons for citizens that come out of that. The first is about voting. In the next election, Charlie Hammer was defeated by 2 votes. His challenger and replacement on the council, Pat Brown, said, "That was my 2 daughters voting absentee from Iowa City. So remember, in a city council election, every vote counts." The second lesson is what the Ames Civil Rights Task Force did. It continued to meet and remained vigilant for anti-gay letters and actions in the community. 7 years later, with a new city council, including 4 women, it determined that it was time to bring the issue up again. This involved re-educating the Ames Human Relations Commission. Russ Pounds had left town when it was brought up for a vote on May 28, 1991. The amendment was approved unanimously, and it appears in the Ames City Code. Of course, this was 26 years ago, and the issues have changed. But to find out what the challenges are today and what activism looks like now, listen to Monday's Local Talk program.
Ooh, a teaser. We're going to follow up on some of these issues on Monday. I told Susan she should do a regular Ames political history because she's been involved in so much here, as have other people. But it is really interesting to think about the history of political movements right here in Ames.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Ames is kind of a little gem here in the middle. We have such a great diverse population, you know, thanks to the university and stuff like that. So it's not your just normal Iowa town, that's for sure.
Thanks to both of you for coming in today and telling us about the new exhibit and that bit of history.
No problem. I forgot to mention the exhibit is only up until November 11th. So it's a very short time compared to our other exhibits. So be sure to get in there before November 11th and check it out.
Okay, will do. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Thanks to Dennis Hart, Kirsten Sullivan, Alex Fafar, and Susan Franzen. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You can also listen to today's local talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. So please support KHOI. It's easy to donate or become a member. Just go to our website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting Black Jacket Symphony, recreating Prince's Purple Rain in its entirety, on Tuesday, October 31st at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.